This is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about everything related to contractors, construction, and information to help you run better businesses. Hey guys, welcome back to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about all the ways not to get screwed in the construction industry. Today is another in my series on the 50 state lien laws, and we're covering the state of Mississippi. And today I have the expert in liens from Mississippi, Mr. Adam Stone from Jones Walker. Good morning, Adam. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Hey, so before we dive into the lien stuff for Mississippi, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got in construction law, and, you know, all the good things.
Well, I finished law school way back in 1996 and have practiced in Mississippi my whole career. I do a variety of things, but probably half or maybe a little more than half of my practice is construction law. I don't know, when I was an associate, I worked for someone who was exclusively a construction lawyer, started doing that work and stuff like we're talking about here, liens and bonds and things like that. And I also do construction contract drafting. So, which is another how not to get screwed possibility. And so I've just kind of done that my whole career and represent kind of variety of different clients, some subcontractors, a lot of subcontractors, the occasional GC, and a lot of owners.
Awesome. Awesome. So did you have any background in construction before you went into construction law? I'm just curious.
No, I was a failed music major that went to law school. So no, it just is how I ended up. No background. Like, I think you have a family construction background. I had none of that.
Awesome. Hey. And then born and raised in Mississippi.
Well, I wasn't born there, but here my whole life other than birth. So, grew up in South Mississippi, went to Ole Miss Law School, and then, have been in the Jackson area for probably 20 years.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. So let's dive right in. So in Mississippi, do you have to be a licensed contractor to work in Mississippi?
You do. And we have an extremely aggressive board of contractors here. So, and they've recently updated their regs to make it just about impossible to do anything, including like home renovation in the state of Mississippi without a license. And they will prosecute and get their fines. And I'm sure other states are like this. It's a bit of a protectionist role. So if you're from out of state, you're really going to get hit if you are in here. And they have officers with badges that go around and inspect people.
Really awesome. So, and then a couple of things. So if you don't have a contractor's license, you're required to have one. Are you stopped from enforcing your contract? Like if you're not paid, you don't have any right to enforce your contract?
Yeah, so that's been a change. So okay. At first, that was the case. And then the Mississippi Supreme Court allowed recovery under equitable estoppel. And okay. With the most recent changes in the statute, I noticed that they have managed to take that away. So I would be very concerned that you would be able to have any recovery if you were unlicensed. And our lien law specifically forbids any liens for anyone who's contracting with anyone who's unlicensed. So I think you could even argue that a general contractor that contracted with a subcontractor who was unlicensed would lose the general contractor's lien rights too.
Really?
So, yeah, no, the idea is everybody needs to plead. They don't want everybody ratting and telling on everybody. The board of contractors is really aggressive. I've had to appear in front of them a lot. They'll usually work a deal, but it is an aggressive operation they have there.
So how hard is it to get licensed? Is there classes you have to take, or you just register?
It is really pretty easy. There are the classes, and you have to go take the little tests, but they've accelerated. It used to be it was only quarterly, and you'd have to wait, and they were using that to prevent anyone from being able to bid a job because you'd have to be licensed to bid it. Now you can get a license in less than a week. So to me, it's not too onerous. But the licensing issues are big, and generally in almost any year, there'll be two or three situations usually with a sub that's trying to get the work done and doing something like trying to split their contract in half and sign two contracts to try to get under the number. And that doesn't seem to ever work. And when I get calls about, can I do that? I always tell everyone that they pretty much thought of everything to prevent you from subverting the licensing requirements.
And then you said too, so can people, can you file a complaint with the, like, can a homeowner file a complaint with the licensing board or a property owner? Tell me kind of how that works. I'm interested.
Yeah, so there's a complaint process, and then the board will take it in and review it. And then if there's any, from what they look at, if there's any merit, they'll send the contractor a letter to make them respond. There can be fines levied with that, but the most common thing I've watched them do is force restitution. Okay. And so it's a little problematic to me because it's like a quasi, you know, judicial process that let's just say may lack a little due process. Gotcha. So I don't really like it. If the board tells a contractor you're gonna have to, you know, redo $60,000 worth of work
to keep your license.
Or we're going to fine you and do all this stuff to you. It gets you in a bit of trouble because the appeal from that would be an administrative appeal. And so all the differences going to the public body and all that kind of stuff. So it is not a, that is definitely something that happens and that people do.
Gotcha. Because I mean, there's different states that have different licensing requirements and kind of how they enforce and what they do is all across the board. So I'm always very interested in what it is in state by state.
Yeah, and I was always interested in your state that they don't have one.
No, none at all. None in Texas. It's a wild, wild west out here, right? Yeah. And it's good and bad, right? So let me ask you this on that topic still. So, like, I know most states have a process where a homeowner has to go through, like, a dispute resolution process before they can sue, like, a residential contractor. Is that, do you have that in Mississippi?
No. You could file a lawsuit without it. There are things you would have to do if you're going to sue under the New Home Warranty Act, which is an act that gives warranties beyond the contract. If you were going to make a claim under that act, you would, but a breach of contract claim, you would not.
Okay, good deal. All right, so who has lien rights in Mississippi?
So lien rights in Mississippi is interesting because we were the last state to even give subcontractors lien rights. So until about 6 or 7 years ago, no one other than GCs and design professionals did. But now, general contractors, subs, suppliers to general contractors, suppliers to subs, licensed architects, professional engineers, professional land surveyors have lien rights. Third tier subs and suppliers don't have lien rights.
Okay, so third tier don't. Gotcha. I think the federal bond claim laws are that way, and most states are either everything or cut off at the third tier as well.
Yeah, and our lien law has been written to be in line with our Little Miller Act. So the bonds and the liens sort of go hand in hand.
Okay, so in Mississippi, when you have, so you've had lien rights, is there any difference in the steps a contractor on a home or residence have to take than a commercial project?
There is. So on a home, residential, single family home, there's a requirement of a preliminary notice that be filed 10 days prior to filing what is called a claim of lien.
Okay.
And so it's pretty well drafted to make sure it's almost impossible to comply with. So you'd have to file the preliminary notice, then the claim of lien, then the notice of filing of the lien, and then the suit to enforce the lien. So you have four things as a homeowner to file, which is different from commercial where you would not have to file that first preliminary notice.
Okay, so you have to, so as a residential contractor, if you want to lien on somebody's homestead or house that they're working on, you have to file the preliminary notice within 10 days of filing the lien or 10 days of first work?
10 days prior to filing the claim of lien.
And when is the deadline to file the claim of lien? Is there any deadlines?
Yeah, not later than 90 days after the last provision of work, labor, or material.
Okay, so like at 80 days at least. And you're filing this where? Where is the notice of?
You're going to file that with the Chancery Court in the county where the property is located. Mississippi has a two-court system. We have courts of law and courts of equity. Our Chancery Courts are courts of equity. Gotcha. So that would be filed in our Chancery Clerk's office.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So is that where all real property records are kept? Or is it just the, okay, gotcha.
Yep, and they handle divorces, real property disputes, lots of injunctions, and oddly enough, and sometimes very terribly, like corporate disputes. They're not, I mean, the largest thing those courts see are family law matters.
Gotcha, gotcha. Okay, so we file this prelim notice 10 days before we file it. Can you file it sooner?
Not less than, yes, you can.
Okay, so you can file it sooner. And then you, okay, so you send that over, you're still not paid, you file the lien within 90 days of last work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to send a copy of that lien to the homeowner?
Well, not later than, the notice of filing of lien is filed 2 days, not later than 2 days after the filing the claim of lien.
Okay, gotcha.
And then you file the suit to enforce the lien not later than 180 days from the date of filing of the lien. So,
okay, go ahead.
Well, so that, and but that can be shortened. So if the property owner files a notice of contest, the 180 days becomes 90 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Damn. Okay. So if nothing happens in that 180 days, if the owner doesn't file their contest and you don't file suit in 180 days, does the lien expire?
Yes. And that has to be printed. Our statute has forms in it, and in the form it says this lien will be ineffective after 180 days. So
gotcha. It is. Okay, I mean, so it says it right on it.
It's
so,
right on the form when you file.
So unlike like here, even though a lien is expired, a title company or somebody who's selling property still wants a release or a court order. Is that an issue in Mississippi since it says right on it?
Right. No, we deal with that a lot when we're representing property owners or sometimes even lenders, you know, the title insurance companies, I don't know that I've ever seen anyone more skittish than real estate lawyers.
Absolutely.
So they jump up and so people can do that. Now there are penalties for falsely filing liens.
Okay.
So if you were to, I would not advise anyone to ever knowingly file an invalid lien, because if you had a motivated owner, they could hammer you for, I think, three times the amount of the lien. So yeah, mm-hmm. You could get hammered and attorney's fees. So I would be careful about thinking, well, I'm going to gum this up with their
title company
without making sure that you actually have valid lien rights.
Gotcha. Okay. So say the contractor moves forward with this and files suit, are they entitled to get their attorney's fees for having to do that?
There is a provision that I've never seen written, and the way it's written is it's 857405C. The court in its discretion may award reasonable costs, interest, and attorney's fees to the prevailing party in an action against the owner to enforce a lien against the property. So it's a two-way. You mean, you file the lien and lose, you're going to pay their fees potentially and vice versa, but it's in the court's discretion. My experience is here, at least, courts generally detest awarding attorney's fees, even in the face of a contract provision. Yeah. And I would think, unless you've done something to really irritate the court or something truly unfair, I would think that you're not likely to recover your attorney's fees if it's in the court's discretion.
No, I agree. We had something similar here, and it was discretionary. And I think in 2011, they changed it to shall for commercial projects. Mm-hmm. And I still can't get courts to follow that, but. Anyways, most courts don't understand mechanics liens, and they kind of dread dealing with them.
Yeah, no, and then I mean, what you're going to get is, why can't you folks work this out?
Exactly, so. Exactly. It's like, I just want to get paid. I just want to get paid the money I'm owed, right?
Right, and so, I mean, but, and they're, you know, they've got a child custody issue coming right behind you, so they don't really
This is not definitely not interesting to them.
No.
Okay, so that's for the homestead. So so like all the other projects, are they the same? Do they have the same steps, or
little bit different. And what I just said with the filing of the notice of commencement there, that's for subs and below. If you have a direct contract with the owner, you don't have to file that.
Okay.
So for a commercial project, you don't have to file the notice of commencement, but you still have, but you have to file a preliminary notice.
Okay.
You have to file a notice, but within 30 days of first applying labor services, you're going to have to file a notice of commencement. You don't have to file that for single family residential.
Okay. You're doing the 10 days before you file the lien, you're filing that lien notice.
So you would file the notice of commencement, then it would go the three steps: claim a lien, notice of filing of lien, suit to enforce lien. So if you're residential, you have to file the preliminary notice not less than 10 days prior to filing the claim. If you're commercial, you have to file notice of commencement within 30 days of first supplying labor or material.
And is that filed at the same place with the chancery court?
It is.
Okay. And so they just basically
copy to the owner.
Okay. And it basically just says, I'm working on this project. If I'm unpaid, I can file a lien.
Correct. And the point is to make, it's going to be to make sure that the owner knows to ask for lien waivers for that party. So it's not unfair, but my experience is, especially with the newness of our statute, as most of the people who've called me have failed, their subs have failed to file that. And so they're dead. They're dead in the water before we even start.
So, I was going to ask, there's no way to cure that or anything? Or
no, you're just going to have to come in with your breach of contract action.
Yeah.
That's against the general. Or you can, I don't even think, the way our courts strictly construe the lien law, I don't even think actual notice of your existence. One thing I've seen work is subcontractors have claimed that they actually had a contract with the owner because the owner approved them. I think if it was a situation where the owner specifically approved that subcontractor, you could argue that that's a direct relationship and try to get around it. There might be some creative solutions, but they're all imperfect.
Hey, what about this? You know how the subcontract incorporates the prime contract?
Right.
Could you use that?
I would think not. But
you only get the obligations, not the benefits, right?
Right. I would say, because it wouldn't go to the owner. I would think the provision that says that the owner has the right and authority to approve all subs.
Okay.
And then which is, kind of a standard AIA.
Then
actually approve that sub. Like if they got sent a list of subcontractors, I would think that would be the point where I would be willing to make the argument that you approve there, and that the notice of commencement didn't make any sense. You got a list right here. You got the notice.
You know who they are.
Right.
So this 30-day doesn't is not required for a GC or a original contractor with the owner.
There's going to be a sub and material supplier to a sub.
Gotcha.
Anybody who doesn't have a direct contractual relationship with the owner.
And so then is it the same 90 days after last work that they need to file a lien?
Yes, 90 days, and then notice of filing of lien 2 days, and then suit to enforce lien 180 days that could be shortened to 90.
Well, at least you're pretty consistent on what's required, and it's not a whole lot of all over the place for different types of projects.
It is. It's basically there are five things, and I have a little a chart that I wrote when I did the section on this in the Mississippi Encyclopedia of Law, it's not terrible to follow. I don't really think many non-lawyers who don't do it a lot would get it right.
No, absolutely not. So, I this is such a fine niche area of the law. Most attorneys wouldn't get it right unless this is what they do.
Yeah, I would agree that if the attorney doesn't regularly handle liens, that it would be unlikely that the attorney would get it right. I mean, it's possible if you found the right book and there's a flow chart, you would do it. But it's pretty clearly designed to give maximum opportunity to make an error that would bar your claim.
Exactly. Well, and plus, this is a very, here's the rules, you either follow them or not. Most other types of law can be argued one way or the other.
And
are somewhat fuzzy. This is definitely not anything that can be argued. Even in a court of equity, they're going to be like, the law says on the 30th day. But what kills me is the ramifications if you get it wrong and you file the lien anyways, right? Yeah. Attorney's fees, penalties. Yep. Because don't get me wrong, a lien is a great remedy and lots of leverage, but you got to do it right.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And not, this is probably true in other states too, but the way going back 100-year case law in Mississippi is that liens are not a creature of common law, and so they're statutory creations and therefore strictly construed. So So that's the argument that prevented subcontractors from having lien rights for 100 years in Mississippi, because it says contractor, it doesn't say subcontractor. So the idea that they're going to expand 30 days to 31 days is not really likely to happen.
No, absolutely not. And so, like, okay, and so, like, when you're sending notices, is that certified mail or is it personal delivery? What is that?
Yeah, let's see. I think generally it's certified mail. Okay. Notice of filed claim, certified mail or statutory overnight delivery. So you're going to want something where you get the signature. And if you don't, I think that would be strictly construed as well.
I agree. Okay, so for material suppliers, I know this is a question I get for a lot of, like, what level of incorporation does a material supplier have to prove to have a lien? So, like, a material supplier gives it stuff to the sub comes, picks it up at their facility, and they don't know if it actually makes it to the job site. So in order for them to have a valid lien, is a signed delivery ticket enough, or do they need delivery, or do they have to prove actual incorporation to the building?
So there is no case law in our new statute. So, because it's so new, so it's unclear to me. My answer is that you would probably have to prove incorporation into the project, because the way the statute reads is that material used in improving the project is going to be what's lien. So I would feel pretty strongly, if I were arguing on the part of an owner, that you would need proof of it being delivered to the site and put into the project. I mean, I think an owner could even argue, and it's not like some GCs don't do this, if you delivered it to my site and then the GC playing some game trucked it to another site, I don't think the owner would be responsible for that either. Yeah. So I think you're going to need to try to make sure you know it's going into the project.
Okay, and that answers my next question too, especially fabricated materials that aren't actually delivered. Some states allow, like Texas allows a lien rights for that. But if you're saying it has to be used, then I don't think that would be allowed.
The statute says used in improving the project. So I think no is the answer to that.
Gotcha. All right. And then is a construction lender at all involved in the lien process, or would it be helpful to let them know?
I mean, I would always let them know, because they'll put the pressure on, and they have to get notice as a lien holder. So, I mean, when you send your lien, you're going to have to send it to them as well. And when you file your suit, you're going to have to make them a party.
Okay, because they have an interest in the property?
Sure. So you're going to have to get all the lien holders, the owner, and any other liens. You try to get one. I mean, the goal is to have one lawsuit with everybody.
With all the liens in there.
Oh, right. So, nice. Yeah. So that's how they're involved. They're not involved any other way. But I've never not copied the
lender.
The lender. I mean, I think they need to know.
I agree. And I think it gives, especially if you're representing the lien claimant, it gives them leverage and just trying to get paid.
Sure.
Okay. Can you have a lien on a lease space?
You can. It's specifically allowed in the contract to the extent of the improvement. But you then have to pay the rent. Meaning,
yeah, exactly. I never understood. You get the opportunity to take the space and pay rent, right? I mean,
right.
You know, it's a threat than any, like, you know.
I mean, I think like on an office build out, right? Like if our office is here and you had whatever 30,000 square feet of space and you've built it out with conference rooms or whatever, you want to use them and we didn't pay our contractor. I mean, kicking a law firm out of their law firm would probably
get you paid.
Yeah,
exactly. So
I would probably think that it would be okay on certain projects, but it's.
Okay.
I've tiptoed into doing that once or twice, but no one's ever really actually wanted to go through with that.
I agree. It's usually the threat. So I have another thing in this state that I haven't, is that if it's not paid for and it wouldn't damage the property to be removed. So like appliances, mm-hmm. or something like that, we can go remove them.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the threat of doing that is actually better than the dollar value of what you're going to get for used stuff. Is that something that they allow in Mississippi?
So under the old statute, they certainly did.
Right.
I would think that to the extent, I think the answer is yes. I know that under the old statute, that was absolutely the case. Let's see what I have here.
I'm just curious. I'd forgotten about that because we don't usually use it that And normally it's just the threat of coming to take it, like light fixtures or something like that. I had that once.
I think it's going to, you know, I don't have anything on that. The statute on that is 85.7.411. Gotcha. So I don't know specifically. I know under the old statute, the answer was yes, that was the law. But I have not actually run across that under the new statute.
That's all right. I was just curious. Okay, so what about public projects? Bonds required at what level?
Bonds required for any project over $25,000. So it is pretty strict. And it's actually a little different. It's for the, a state project is different. I think it's maybe even $5,000 for a state project versus a municipality or county is $25,000 is what I think. But yeah, it, almost any significant project is going to require a bond in the amount of the contract.
Gotcha. And so what are the notice requirements on that, on a public project?
90 days after notice is 90 days after performing labor or material.
90 days after last work?
Mm-hmm. No, yes. 90 days after last work. And then I think the lawsuit is 1 year.
Is it 1 year from the time the project's complete or from the time you finish work?
Hold on a second.
No worries.
I think the answer to that is, hold on. Ooh, you got another book here.
You're good. You're good. No worries.
Yeah, no. So, ninth day, suit and forms must be brought within 1 year after the owner makes final payment.
Okay. So, the 1 year after the project's
done. That's what I thought. Okay.
So, good deal. And then, so you're sending, when you send notice of the bond, of your bond claim, you send that to the bond company and to the general contractor?
Yes.
Do you have to send it to the municipality or the public entity? No.
I mean, I typically send it to the owner as well.
Gotcha.
But I'm more, I mean, I don't know that a public body is going to care so much.
Yeah, exactly.
Under our private lien statute, I make sure I send it to the owner.
Absolutely. And so, and when you have to file suit to enforce your bond claim, do you get attorney's fees?
That is not in the statute. Unless there's, you could get it another way, but not likely.
Gotcha. And then where, like how, if somebody was a subcontractor or a material supplier on a public works project, how would they get a copy of the bond?
Yeah. So our statute requires, and that's, what is that statute? It requires giving 31.555 requires anyone who provides labor on a project to provide a copy of that contract or, and a copy of any bond upon request.
Okay. So you request it from the general?
Mm-hmm. So if you're a sub, request from the general. If you're a sub with a subcontractor's bond, request it from the sub. And I've seen people play games with that, but the statute requires it. So I think that you would get it.
Within how many? Does it have a timeline of when they have to provide it to you?
It doesn't say, but okay. I think if they were playing games with that, you could
get it extended.
Yeah, and I would want that. I mean, I would like probably file something and think that'd be a good way to start my case.
I agree.
Somebody refusing to give me
the bond. Exactly.
And I try to tell people, I try to tell subs on the front end two things that, you know, when I look at one of their contracts that, you know, the flow down clauses, you know, actually go get a copy of the contract and look at it. I mean, you said you've read it. You might want to read it.
The prime contract,
go ahead and get a copy of the bond and put it in a file in your office so that you've got it when you need it. And just tell them that it's just part of your process, that your lawyer said I should do these two things every time.
Yep. And, because it's a lot easier to get when you're not in a dispute.
I mean, sure.
Because
they weren't planning to screw you at that point.
Exactly. Everybody was on the same page.
Right.
I
try to tell people to do that. I don't know how successful I am in getting them to do it. Because on the front end, they don't really want to make waves, but generally I've been able to get that.
No, but I mean, and that's another, the hot topic that I like to discuss is the current state of subcontracts.
Oh, they're horrible. They're horrible. And I represent a very large national subcontractor, and we represent them in a lot of states. And I mean, big. I mean, bigger than most generals, like 900 employees. And they have leverage, so we end up arguing a lot with them, and I'm able to get changes. For most of our smaller clients that are working for the big generals, no. I mean, the contracts are so unfair as to be absurd. Oddly enough, I've found that in other parts of the country outside of the South, that they're not quite as onerous. Like the Midwest contracts seem to be a little friendlier. The ones down here, though, if you're dealing with the big generals like Yates Construction or someone like that,
there's no negotiating.
There's no negotiation, and they're extremely, extremely onerous to the point that it's, you know, sometimes I look at it and like the basically it's like it's a contract that says I can't win.
No, even if I do a great job, I'm not going to win.
Yeah, and I've litigated on that one specifically a few times, and have gotten them to pay me. And like through the years, I've actually just developed a good relationship with their general counsel, so I can usually get him to cough up a little money if as long as we're reasonable and right. I mean, he's never going to pay us if we're not right. Okay. But I'm usually able to get somewhere. But I'm having to basically beg, borrow.
It is amazing to me. Like I can remember the first time I read a subcontract. I'm like, who the hell would sign this?
Yeah.
And the problem was, is they were never reading them. And then that just became the standard.
Yeah. And then at this point in the work, I mean, it can change. I mean, if you have leverage, I mean, I would advise subs to try to think about their leverage. If you're a specialty sub and they need you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then take a harder line. But I mean, it's really difficult if there are hundreds of flooring subcontractors that are looking for the job. So I always tell clients, it's my job to tell you your risks. And so I'll read a contract and I'll highlight them out and I'll tell them what the problems are in them. And it's your job to assess risk. You're the business person.
Exactly.
So I don't want you to go out of business because you failed to take a job on a bad contract. I get you're going to have to take risks, but you at least know what you're taking so that you can price it. You know, like
price
if you have two job options and one of them has an onerous contract, and one of them done, maybe you want to take the, you know, at least be able to balance your risk better.
Absolutely. I think that's our job. Our job is to let you know what the risk is, then you can decide if you want to take it or not.
Sure. I mean, there's nothing you can do. The environment is difficult.
Absolutely. And you would think I'm trying, you know, my hardest, and I think everybody out there that I talk to on this issue is trying their hardest to do what we can. If everybody will start to push back, we can make some ground, right? Mm-hmm. And it's never just cross it out and we're not going to sign it. It's let's have a negotiation. Let's meet in the middle. Because for some reason, all of the risk has gotten pushed on the subs.
Sure. And I've been able to get some with that, especially with, I have a specialty sub that does very narrow bit of work that generals don't typically want to do. It's kind of heavy concrete work.
Gotcha.
And they've reached the point that there are certain contractors, big contractors, national contractors, they just will not work for, period. Like they've done two jobs, got burned two times, and it's like, you know what? We're done. Just go somewhere else. Yeah. And with that approach, so I mean, I had something that was a different issue. It was a bid issue. They sent a contractor for a public project, sent a document over that wanted our client to promise not to bid the other generals. And
what?
He said he wanted them only to bid his job and not the other generals. And our guy said, I'll promise not to share your numbers.
Yeah,
but I'm not gonna shop you or anything like that. But I'm not. No, I'm bidding all the generals, and I was able to get that. They needed him. If they lost him, they would not get the job. And I was able. So I remembered that and told the client, look, next time this comes up, like if you get this job and he sends you a subcontract, he needs you. So let's
negotiate.
Let's negotiate.
Exactly. All right. Any other wise word of advice to contractors that are working in Mississippi or in general that you'd like to give?
No, I mean, I think you hit it. I mean, I think be licensed. That's really important. It's not that hard. I think get copies of your contract and your bonds on the front end. Be mindful of your deadlines. If you're a sub, remember the notice of commencement if you're doing anything other than single family residential work. And on liens, details You know, as we discussed, details matter. So, you know, be organized, have your documents in order. And when you're not paid, I mean, I guess to get back to the name of your podcast is, don't listen to the song and dance, you know, like the Hamburglar, or, you know,
I'll pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today.
That's not the Hamburglar. That's a Wimpy
from
Popeye. You know, don't believe them when they say that, because your times are running, and if you've not been paid and you want to assert your lien rights, you know, you're going to have to do it. So, you know, if you're 70, 80 days out, it's time to file, and you can do it politely.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
But be polite.
And don't assume for 1 second they don't know what your timelines are.
Yeah, no, right. And, or even if they don't know, don't for 1 second think that they're not going to take advantage of them.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, just you can't let your time flitter away. Most of the time when I get a call, it is already after the time. And
yeah,
we're just paying catch up. I mean, it's just like trying to find a way. So.
No, and I think anybody in the construction industry should take the time and have built a consistent collection strategy that triggers, and it can be earlier than the timelines of the state, right? It could be, I could send an extra notice at 60 days if I wanted to. I can always send more notice and extra. I just can't do less.
Right.
So, I think
that's right. And I think know your contract. I mean, and that's tough. But I mean, like I'm doing a bunch of contracts for owners right now, for across their whole international, local, everywhere. And, you know, we try to go and meet with them after we draft them and then like teach them, because I have found over and over again, and not just in construction, but in sales contracts too, for like UCC, that our clients, even really big, sophisticated companies, do not actually, their people don't always know their own contract. And so we fought a big old collection issue on a sale of steel, where our client for years was steadily just kind of letting things go. They thought that they had to fix something that they didn't have to fix. And so we ultimately win, but we ended up spending 3.5 years in litigation over a issue that they could have put the foot down on day one if they just known their own contract.
Well, exactly. And honestly, guys, the purpose of a contract is to manage expectations and the relationships between the parties. That's really the job of it. But if you don't know what it says, it can't do that.
Correct. And the other thing that comes up to me a lot, and this is not on your lien topic, is that if there is ambiguity, if you don't really know what it means, you know, clarify that provision. And you know, that happened the other day where the general contractor told our client, well, the intent of that provision is, and if it doesn't say it, that's not going to be good enough, you know, four corners doctrine, all that kind of stuff. You know, I was like, well, if that's the intent, then let's just take a pen, let's scratch out that sentence, and let's write a new one where the intent's a little more clear. And we can reach agreement on that intent, but don't tell me it says something that I don't think it says, because I don't want to get into that. So, you know, ambiguities are not good.
Well, and here's the other thing, is that I don't think a document has to be full of legalese to be effective. There's no reason. It's actually less ambiguous and clearer if it's just in plain English. Just say whatever you're going to say.
Yep.
Just say it so like everybody can understand it, right?
Oh, yeah.
I've really tried to do that, especially when I draft my residential contracts. Very much plain English.
Yeah, no. I mean, you need to get that. I mean, we've been trying to get that out of all. You know, we like Brian Garner here, so like when we're writing briefs, we're trying to get the legalese out of our briefs as well. And so you try to create a cleaner reading document. You know, the goal is to be understandable. I believe in headings. I believe in segregated sections and things that are really clear on what the obligations of the parties are. And then certainly what you said. I think if you're a subcontractor having to, you know, if it were my company, I would be like, when I bid the job, is there a bond? Because in Mississippi, if there's a bond, there are no lien rights. I had not said that.
Okay.
Is there a bond? Yes. Here's my deadlines. If there's not a bond, liens, what do I have to do? And here are my deadlines. And I would know it on the front end so that each job was coded for whether I had lien rights or bond rights or no rights at all.
And the process is the same no matter what.
Yeah. That's the only way to protect yourself. Because otherwise, if you're counting on some guy that's busy and trying to find a better price on rebar, he's going to miss it.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Awesome. So we'll put all your contact information in the show notes. So if anybody wants to reach out to you, and, you know, and I was looking at your bio, I mean, tons of articles, lots of experience. It's pretty impressive. So we'll put all that in the show notes. But thank you so much for being here today and sharing your wealth of knowledge. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And good luck over in Texas, in the land of the unlicensed.
It's fun. Awesome. Thank you for listening to this episode of Quit Getting Screwed. I hope you found it helpful. If you like what you hear, please like us and follow our podcast. If you want further information, you can find us at subcontractorinstitute.com. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And the book is available on Amazon. Thank you.